Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne here at 88.5 KRFY, Community Radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month. The show is also rebroadcast at 8 a.m. on the third Monday, and you can tell your friends they can stream this show and every KRFY show at krfy.org. from anywhere in the world, or they can listen to a podcast of the show at krfy.org and select podcasts. The monthly topics here will feature the medical designations of the month, at least for this year. Since this is October, I'm focusing on October as Breast Cancer Month. I have here in the studio with me Dr. Hannah Robbins, breast cancer and general surgeon from Sandpoint Surgical Associates, and Cynthia Dalsing, nurse practitioner, who is a breast cancer patient. I'm sure that we'll have a most informative session. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Also in the studio is Susie Perez from our KRFY morning show, all-around rock star here at KRFY, and as my executive producer, she enables the station to offer these discussions. Hello, Susie, and thanks for being here.
Hello, Dr. Joanne, and thanks for introducing the show today. Medical Musing provides KRFY listeners interesting and informative interviews on a variety of medical and health-related subjects. And thank you for hosting Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne. Dr. Joanne.
That was your addition.
I know. I added that. I wanted to let the listeners know a little bit about who you are. So here you go. Dr. Joanne is a longtime KRFY volunteer, previously broadcasting segments of Otto's Eclectic Mix, and now hosting Medical Musing on the first and third Monday of the month at 8 a.m. She is a retired pediatrician who has lived in Sandpoint since 2010. She previously worked as a pediatric practice in Columbus, Ohio for over 30 years and then covered at Sandpoint Pediatrics. As the media spokesperson for the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, she contributed to print, online media, radio, and television. She is the mother of four adult children, and we are fortunate to have Medical Musing as part of our Monday morning programming.
Thank you, Susie. I want to give a little history of Breast Cancer Month, and then we'll get into our discussion. Breast Cancer Month was initially designated as such by the American Cancer Society in 1985. It's a collaboration between the American Cancer Foundation, the American Academy of Family Practice, and the AstraZeneca Foundation. The focus is to promote early detection via mammography and follow-up tests as needed, and to support those with breast cancer and their loved ones. They educate the public about risk factors, and of course, need to do fundraising to continue the mission as stated above, but primarily to support research on this topic. In 1983, the first Komen Race for the Cure occurred, but it wasn't until 1991 that the Komen Foundation used the pink ribbons, and that was picked up the following year by Self Magazine and the Esther Lauder Foundation. It is estimated that more than 360,000 people will be diagnosed with breast cancer in 2024. In the United States, one in eight women has the chance of being diagnosed with breast cancer over her lifetime. And although death rates decreased by 40% from 1989 to 2016 due to early detection, it's still noted that 30% of the early diagnosis patients can later develop metastatic disease. That's a scary statistic, but I've also read from the American Cancer Society data that five-year survival rates in the U.S. and the U.K. vary between 80 and 90%. So that's a very reassuring statistic. Men have breast cancer, too. One in every 100 breast cancer patients are men. We'll be talking a lot about the diagnosis, but also about the changes and improvements in breast cancer diagnosis and treatment. Why don't you introduce yourselves, Dr. Robbins, and then Cynthia.
I'm Dr. Hannah Robbins. I'm a general surgeon here in Sandpoint, Idaho. I'm a general surgeon by training, and I became a general surgeon because I was inspired by a few things that happened to my mother. We were doing a bicycle tour of the entire West Coast, and she had a really bad accident and ended up as a trauma patient in California at a big hospital there. And that was a big formative time in my life. And then a few years later, she developed breast cancer and ended up having bilateral mastectomies and reconstruction, and had quite the journey. And she's been disease-free for many years now. But both of those experiences helped push me towards a career in general surgery, where I would treat both trauma patients and cancer patients. And my mom's been a big influence in my life. And so that's one of the big reasons why I chose general surgery in the first place. And so I'm interested in a broad spectrum of general surgery. And that's one reason why I like to live in a smaller place, because I'm able to do trauma, take trauma call, treat breast cancer, and then do things like colonoscopies and, you know, bread and butter general surgery. So I do have a special interest in breast cancer. I knew that as a female general surgeon, breast cancer would be a big part of my practice. And so I focused on that in my training. And I'm a member of the American Society of Breast Surgeons and go to their conferences, and am really trying to bring high quality breast cancer care to Sandpoint. And I think it was here before, but I think people just weren't very aware of it, and we're trying to get the news out.
That's wonderful. Where did you train?
I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Washington. Then I spent 2 years studying pathogenesis of salmonella in the lab before medical school. I did medical school at the University of Washington, did some research at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center on some of the pathogenesis of cancer cells. In my mind, this was similar to the pathogenesis of bacteria, which is what I studied earlier, and then had a special interest in surgical oncology, and then went to the Oregon Health Science University, which is the academic center in Portland. My thought was that I would go into surgical oncology, but during my training, I changed my mind and decided to do general surgery and rural general surgery. And a big part of that was because my husband and I had 2 babies during residency, and I didn't want to extend my training by another 2 years.
That sounds familiar. I had 2 babies during med school and 1 during my training. And Cynthia?
I am so impressed with medical students and residents who have a baby during that, because it is a most grueling time. I obtained my bachelor's degree from the University of Iowa, and then I had a master's degree from the University of Utah in maternal child nursing, which enabled me to take boards to become a certified nurse midwife. And I have been a certified nurse midwife for over 40 years. I actually just, in high school, had a very strong interest in women's care and women's health. And obviously, midwifery was just a logical choice. Mm-hmm. I practiced here in Sandpoint for about 25 years.
Yeah, Sandpoint's very fortunate to have both of you, you ladies. So let's start with Dr. Robbins, and we'll talk about the diagnosis. And Susie also brought something up, so we'll add her comment. But basically the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends that all women get screened for breast cancer every other year, starting at age 40 and continuing through age 74. So again, I went to get my mammogram, or a lady gets to get a mammogram, and then there is something concerning.
So if you go to get your screening mammogram, it's a pretty broad test. They do just a couple views of the breast, and they're looking for anything that could potentially be abnormal. And so if they find anything at all suspicious, then the radiologist will call you back for something called a diagnostic mammogram. So a diagnostic mammogram's purpose is to hone in on any abnormality from the screening mammogram. So they take more targeted films, and it's usually accompanied by an ultrasound as well. Now, in contrast, if you feel a lump in your breast and you're sent for imaging, that first imaging study is usually a diagnostic study, because we're expecting to diagnose some pathology.
Okay, so I didn't mention self-exams before. So again, that was a really big instruction to everyone to do self-exams.
Yeah, it was a big push previously, but it actually didn't pan out as well as we'd hoped. It turns out that when you kind of increase the fear and anxiety around breast cancer for women and tell them to examine their breasts, we find a lot of false positives. So while I encourage my patients to be familiar with the way that their breasts feel, I don't tell them to check on their calendar to do a breast exam every month. So breast awareness is important, but hypervigilance tends to lead to false positives, meaning if any woman feels a mass in her breast that she feels is new, and she comes to my office, there is no way I will send her out the door without ordering imaging. Yeah. I won't feel that and say, oh, I don't feel what you're feeling, you're fine, go home. Absolutely not. If she feels that it's different, she gets worked up for it. And so what that resulted in was just a landslide of basically unnecessary testing.
Interesting. And then MRIs are done on people with dense breasts. And Susie heard something today. So do you want to talk about that?
Well, the FCC just came out with an order for all screening companies, I guess, to, if a woman is diagnosed with dense breast tissue, that she would get a notice in the mail saying that it's dense breast tissue and that cancer can hide in dense breast tissue easier.
Mm-hmm.
And explain that a little bit more. So that's a big change, and I think that that will help a lot.
Well, I was saying that I have experience with people with dense breasts, and they are getting MRIs. So I don't know, again, if that's, it depends on where you live and how knowledgeable your doctors are. But she's had several MRIs over the last.
And don't you think a lot of women have dense breasts on mammograms? And that is something that, until like this kind of direct parameter, has not necessarily been communicated to women in terms of further screening. So I think that's important that they've looked at that.
They say about 50% of women have the dense breast tissue.
And I wonder, too, if putting it on the line there in writing will encourage insurance companies to pay for it, too.
Yeah, that's
as it goes down the road.
I think it'll also heighten awareness of patients and their primary care physicians to use some of the good tools that are out there to estimate breast cancer risk. So if any woman has a 20% or higher lifetime risk of breast cancer, then she should be screened with annual MRIs in addition to annual mammograms. So that's our high-risk screening protocol. So people who have, you know, the famous breast cancer genes get that, but also people who just have increased risk due to things like family history, breast density, and the commonly thrown around things such as, you know, how old were you when you started your period? When did you have your first baby? Did you breastfeed your babies? All of those things help us to estimate breast cancer risk. And if that's over 20%, then you should have that high-risk screening. But breast density has been a component of those calculators for some time, but people, I think, just haven't been aware of that.
It wasn't that recognized. So, Cynthia, tell us about your experience if you can or want to or will.
No, I'm happy to, because I hope women can take away information from this that will help them, because I was really caught off guard because, of course, I'm still doing self-breast exams, and I felt a lump, and I knew it had not been that long since I'd had my mammogram. In fact, I went back and checked the date, and I'd had a mammogram in April that was normal, and in December, I had quite a large lump that was easy to feel, and I actually felt kind of ridiculous making a visit for a mammogram, because I thought, well, I've had one recently, and of course they did a mammogram, and they actually did a diagnostic mammogram on the breast that I felt the lump in, but they went ahead and did a screening mammogram in the other breast, and so I knew that one breast was normal, but in the diagnostic mammogram, they actually found a separate lump, totally different cancer, And I kept thinking they were looking in the wrong place. And they said, no, there's a lump down here. So I can just encourage people, if you have any thought that you are unsure about your exam, go and have someone look at it. And we kind of had a mantra that a breast lump is a problem until you know and have proven by pathology usually that it is not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that leads me to the, since there are so many blood tests we're going to talk about in just a minute, but it used to be that you'd have a frozen, that you'd go in for a biopsy, and then they would, sometimes it would be a frozen section, they would decide right then, and then you'd have a mastectomy, or you'd have the biopsy, find out, you know, what grade, and how the cells are differentiated, and then follow up with a CAT scan or another radiologic procedure to check for metastases. And then you'd have your plan with your oncologist and your surgeon. Is that correct, or have things changed a bit?
So things have changed a bit. We start with imaging, and then the imaging generally will look at both the breast and the armpit, the axilla. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking for is any abnormal lymph nodes in the armpit, mm-hmm. Because the first place that breast cancer spreads from the breast is to the axilla. And then after the imaging, the radiologist will say, this is suspicious, we should do a biopsy, or this isn't that suspicious, let's look again in 3 months. So next is often, if we're going down the cancer route, a patient will get a biopsy, often of both a breast mass and any suspicious lymph nodes. And then that pathology specimen goes through a litany of tests. Mm-hmm. Gone are the days where you just say cancer and treat it as the one size fits all. Because what we've found is that there are multiple different types of breast cancer, three main types, and they behave very differently. And the treatment for them is usually quite different, and the prognosis is quite different.
It's just fascinating, because that's, as you know, my friends have been, or developed breast cancer perhaps 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and then versus 10 years ago, it's like triple positive, triple negative, HER positive, mm-hmm. BRCA 1, BRCA 2. I mean, there's so many different classifications. So let's talk a little bit about it. If you want to start, Dr. Robbins, that'd be great.
Absolutely. So there are three main types of breast cancers. We call them clusters. And they're defined by the genes in their DNA that they express. And so the most common type of breast cancer is a luminal type. This is characterized by the estrogen gene cluster. And so that's why you hear about estrogen receptor positive mm-hmm. tumors. So the estrogen receptor positive tumors tend to behave better. They have the best prognosis. They're the most favorable. But they're also the most common. So still, most breast cancer deaths occur in women with these luminal cancers because they're by far the most common. Mm-hmm. There's a subset of luminal cancers called luminal B, as opposed to luminal A, which are slightly less favorable. The next subtype is the HER2, or human epidermal growth factor, cluster. And so if a woman has a breast cancer, they also test the breast cancer not only for the estrogen receptor, but this HER2, HER2. And that's because this second type of breast cancer is defined by this cluster of genes controlled by that particular gene, HER2. These cancers tend to behave more badly. However, we have targeted chemotherapy that specifically targets that HER2 gene and can treat these cancers. And so while it's a more aggressive type of cancer, they don't necessarily translate to worse outcomes because we have more targeted therapies for those cancers. And then the last, or the third cluster, is called the basal cluster. This is typically associated with what we hear about triple negative breast cancer. So the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2 receptors are all negative. These tend to be controlled by this cluster of genes that's typically more aggressive. The cells proliferate more quickly, and they spread to other parts of the body more readily.
So if you hear someone say triple negative, you just think in your mind, yes, of course, that's the worst prognosis than the others. Years ago, I know they tested for estrogen because I remember I have a friend who actually in 1989 and 90 had two different cancers within a year or two of each other. She had her breast, she was estrogen receptor positive, so she took a blocker. She had no chemo, no radiation. I mean, this is pretty amazing. And then she had uterine cancer, had hysterectomy, no chemo, and no radiation. And after a while, my medical partner's husband was an adult hematologist oncologist. And I finally said, you have to go see Ralph, just to be sure, because her surgeon, I mean, it must have been so small or so, you know, we don't know, because again, it was in 1989 and people didn't always share things like that, but it must have been just, you know, small enough and that she could be treated just by surgery. Susie.
What I'm hearing you say is that there's such good diagnostics now that you can get targeted treatment. You can know if it's aggressive. You can know if it's moved on, metastasized, I guess they call it. And that is the really good news. It's still a scary thing.
Oh, it's very scary.
And I'm also hearing that regular screenings and or if you feel something, do something kind of attitude would be a good thing. Yeah. And then if you're screening people don't find anything, but you still feel something, you can always get a second, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have many patients who got their mammogram last year and then felt a lump within the next 6 months, especially those faster growing tumors. Mm-hmm. They'll arise in a year. So if you find that mass, absolutely go get some imaging.
It's so important, as you said, to be familiar with your breast tissue. So Cynthia, tell us your experience again in having the tumor identified.
Well, it's interesting being on the other side of the aisle because I certainly have a lot of experience with patients who have breast cancer and telling women they have breast cancer. And I understand that of course, this is a scary diagnosis and you're trying to reassure women, but things cannot move quickly enough when you're actually looking at that diagnosis for yourself. And I was fortunate because I knew exactly the ropes to go through. But even with that, it took a month for me to go from having my first mammogram to having surgery. And that was an accelerated course, I would say, because I knew the surgeon and he was pushing everything. So that seems like a long time because when I would see a woman, you know, they want to see the oncologist and have the biopsy the next day and the results later. Yeah. But one thing I would say that I think you guys have stressed, because my aunt died of breast cancer at 44. Mm-hmm. I was 10. And I remember seeing her post-surgical. And at that time, that was kind of considered to be, you're going to die from this. But now breast cancer is really treated as a chronic diagnosis. And so I think the early pickups and the being vigilant, not hyper, but vigilant about your breast and getting second opinions is just wise.
Very good. We didn't talk about BRCA 1 and BRCA 2. So if you want to say a little bit about that, Dr. Robbins, that would be great.
Yeah, so the BRCA genes or the BRCA genes are some pieces of DNA that code for proteins that actually help your body to not form cancers. So they help your body to replicate your own DNA in an accurate way. So these are normal proteins in every cell that help us. And so what has happened is some of those proteins have mutations. And so it puts your body at risk for developing a mutation every time your DNA is replicated. So every time your cell divides, there's a chance that it could develop a new mutation. And so for this particular gene, people are much more likely to develop cancers in the ovaries, the breasts, for men, the prostate, and then for both sexes, the pancreas. Colon, but to a much lesser degree.
And isn't this, I know women would come in and see me very concerned about this, but this is really a very small percentage of breast cancers.
Very small.
Like 2 to 3%?
Very small.
Yeah. And so I think that's important for people to realize. I mean, there's the risk if you have this mutation, and there's a completely separate risk if you have a history of breast cancer. And so it's important that those are two different kind of pathways.
Do you think it's important to get tested for this?
If you have a strong family history of those cancers, especially any man in the family with breast cancer, or multiple folks with prostate, breast, pancreatic, and even melanoma, then I do think you should get tested. If you have a strong family history of breast cancer, I think it's worth bringing it up to your primary doctor, because genome-wide testing, which is where they test all of your DNA, is so common, you know? I mean, my husband did it to find like a long-lost cousin or something. You know, it's really easy to have your DNA tested for medical reasons if you're interested in that. Of course, there are also, you know, theoretical concerns with having your DNA sequence out for the world. So not everyone is comfortable with that.
So is BRCA part of the DNA? Not part of the routine DNA, like if I sent my DNA to MyHeritage or Ancestry or whatever?
So the BRCA genes, we all have them. And hopefully all of ours are working correctly. But some people have specific mutations in those genes that are known to be pathologic mutations.
Mm-hmm. And those show up on the test?
On the test. Not 23andMe. But
not the cheek cell from 23andMe. That's what I was asking.
No, so, they don't. You have to do
a medical
genetic testing.
What about people who are BRCA positive? Angelina Jolie got all this publicity about having her proactive or elective mastectomy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if she had an oophorectomy. That means taking out your ovaries, too. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, generally, and it's different for the BRCA 1 and 2. But in general, we recommend breast cancer screening starts as early as 20 with MRIs, and when the woman is finished with childbearing, we recommend oophorectomy followed by prophylactic mastectomies after childbearing age.
But they test positive for the mutation.
Correct.
But if somebody said, well, I don't want to have any children, I don't want to have anything, you know, will you do it now?
I would do the mastectomies. I would talk to the gynecologist about advantages of keeping ovaries for some period of time, just for bone health and cardiac health. But I'd be perfectly willing to do bilateral, we call them risk-reducing mastectomies in, you know, a woman in her late 20s who feels like she's ready to take that step.
So even if a lady's BRCA negative, do you recommend if a patient came to you and said, I want you to take both breasts. I know my tumor is only one breast. I'd much rather have bilateral mastectomies because I just don't want to deal with this. Is the risk of relapse in another breast or recurrent disease in a metastatic disease in other organs more likely? Or does that play into your decision?
In the absence of a known genetic predisposition to develop breast cancer, it's not recommended to do a contralateral risk-reducing mastectomy. That being said, a lot of women want both breasts removed because imagine if you're a D or an E cup and you have one breast removed and then you have this 5 to 7 pound breast on the other side, you feel lopsided, you can't get a prosthetic that matches. A lot of women have some post-traumatic stress about the workup of their breast cancer, and they just can't imagine going through another mammogram every year. And they don't want to surveil the opposite side. I tend to side very strongly with the patient, and if she has a good reason for wanting a contralateral risk-reducing procedure, then I honor that.
Okay. That sounds familiar. So, Cynthia, you said you had one nodule or one in one breast and then another lump in the other breast. Were they different?
No. It was in the breast where I felt the lump. They found a second lump.
In a different place.
Even though, of course, I checked my breast every single day for a month, I could never feel that lump ever. And it just the position where it was very difficult to feel. And if you have lumpy breasts, once again, it's hard. It's really hard from a manual exam to kind of delineate, this is important, this isn't important. I mean, you really need that additional radiology information to make your best choice.
We talked about dense breasts. Some people just have kind of ropey breasts, too. So were your two lumps, masses, whatever you call them, the same? Did they both get biopsied? Or the other
ones? They both got biopsied, although not at the same time, because the person thought one lump wasn't cancer. So it just goes to show you that you need a biopsy, because that lump ended up being the more aggressive cancer, that when they did genetic testing to see if it could recur, that lump that originally was not biopsied was very high risk for recurrence. So you have to have a biopsy. You just have to. And you can't make good clinical decisions without all your information.
Mm-hmm. So just real quick, you said that there was one lump that they said that's not a problem. It's not cancer?
Yes, and by radiology, just from looking at the ultrasound.
It was an ultrasound that they did, and they said it was a cyst, a benign
cyst? No, they just said they weren't worried about it, and so they weren't going to biopsy it.
Okay, and then, but they found this one that you couldn't feel, and they biopsied that. Then you asked them to go back and biopsy
the other?
Well,
no, of course, when I saw my surgeon, he said, you need that other lump biopsied. Oh. I mean, he was like, of course you need a biopsy, and he arranged to have it that day with results in 2 days. I waited for a week on the other one. So it's just, care can be very different. It can be really halting. I don't like it when people say you're going to get a result in 2 days, because not everybody gets a result in 2 days, because they have such a stringent testing for tissue, and they have such a variety of tests they can do, and they can be more specific with it. I mean, I'm amazed at the options that are now available for cancer treatments. It just kind of blows me away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if the ultrasound, there is another step to an MRI also, to go a little further with, if it's unsure, if the biopsy's not ready or they're not seeing that a biopsy should happen, you can also get an MRI?
Yeah, so MRI is much more sensitive, meaning it picks up more abnormalities, but it's less specific, meaning that sometimes it'll pick up abnormalities that aren't important. And so it's great when we're looking for something, but it's not great for screening, meaning that it picks up a lot of noise. It picks up a lot of things that end up being nothing. But I routinely get MRIs in my patients who have been diagnosed with breast cancer, exactly for the reason that Cynthia mentioned, to see, is there another mass in that breast? Does this tumor actually extend a little further than we think based on the mammogram and the ultrasound? That being said, the data have not panned out that routine MRIs are necessary for every newly diagnosed breast cancer, and it looks like they're overutilized and probably do result in unnecessary biopsies and delays to surgery. So it's a complex balance, but especially if a woman is considering just a lumpectomy and saving the breast, I like to get that MRI because in my hands, I feel that I have more accurate information for taking out that cancer.
The other interesting thing you said is that ultrasounds have gotten so much better, at least I think that's how I'm interpreting it, that they actually do evaluate the lymph nodes. Mm-hmm. It used to be at surgery, you did a lymph node dissection. Yeah. You may still do that, but.
So surgery for breast cancer used to be absolutely barbaric. So a radical mastectomy performed by Dr. Halsted, who is the kind of grandfather of surgery in this country, who had a, I don't know how appropriate this is, a massive cocaine addiction.
Well, there's that.
He removed the breast, removed the pec, minor and major muscles, removed all of the lymph nodes in the armpit, and skin grafted the defect. It was horribly disfiguring, and women didn't want to come in for surgery because
crater.
They knew.
You'd have a crater in your chest.
And they knew that they'd never work on the farm again. You know, they would be horribly disfigured. And now we're in a time where we can see those abnormal lymph nodes by imaging and biopsy them and just take the tumor out. And all we need is no tumor on ink, we say. You don't even need a very big margin. Just barely get that tumor out. And we've found that if women just get that tumor out and do radiation, they have the same survival as you would doing that gigantic, massive surgery. Mm-hmm. So surgery for breast cancer has come a long ways.
Definitely. And then the site of metastases include bone, lung, liver, and brain, which is also becomes... several women that I know, again, were going along quite well, and then... But, of course, they had their primary surgeries perhaps in the 80s or the 90s and then did have some metastatic disease and ended up succumbing to their metastatic mm-hmm. disease. But it sounds like, again, all these advances in treatment are certainly being very helpful. You talked a little bit about the risk factors. So just I'll review them quickly or add to that. Blacks have a worse prognosis, too, or do they just have an increased incidence?
So the African-American population does have a worse prognosis. And the interesting sort of area of research right now is that a lot of Black women who will have these luminal A tumors, so what we think of as good behaving tumors, will actually do much worse than white women when compared. And the thought is that we think that they're this better behaved type of breast cancer when really they're expressing more of the basal, so more of the triple negative type genes, even though they're ERPR positive, HER2 negative, kind of classic good looking tumors. And so that's an area of research right now, because even if you control for socioeconomic status and barriers to care, Black women do worse than their white counterparts. And we think that part of it is just a different gene expression of the tumor. And we haven't sussed that out yet.
Okay, and they'll keep doing research on that.
Yep.
We talked about the hereditary nature and the dense breasts. And when you started your periods and when you went through menopause, because again, that's longer exposure to estrogen, I assume. And the same thing with hormone replacement therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of really went up in use, and then it went down in use, and now it's kind of back with estrogen only and lower dose estrogen, and then the biomimicry mm-hmm. natural thing. So
and what about alcohol, Joanne?
That I was just going to get to.
Oh,
that
okay.
So thank you. Yeah, and previous radiation and alcohol and obesity, and it seems like
smoking,
just so many mm-hmm. so many risk factors. I can remember, again, there was a very well-known surgeon at Ohio State back in the 80s, and the women who would have breast cancer were very strict about, well, soy. Like, we all hopped on, you know, soy milk, and it was like, no, that's estrogen. Mm-hmm. And coffee and milk products, are those the foods that you still recommend people avoiding, or was that an old?
I probably drink 16 cups of coffee a day. So I wouldn't dare recommend anyone else stay away from coffee.
Chocolate.
No, live your life. Don't live in fear.
I don't think there is a lot of data that supports any specific food, and I'm not saying alcohol here, that says food. This causes cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it was just interesting because John Peter Minton was the expert in breast cancer at Ohio State, and all the women that were patients of John Peter Minton came back with those recommendations. So let's go to treatment, because I think we've talked so much about the different classifications or types or whatever you want to call it. So again, a lot of people had the mammogram, they had perhaps an ultrasound, they had a biopsy, then they either had the lumpectomy or the mastectomy, and their nose examined, and they checked for metastases. It definitely was pretty similar. Surgery followed by radiation and chemotherapy and being on an estrogen blocker if you need it. It's a little different now. Can you tell us about that?
So the treatment, the surgical treatment doesn't vary significantly based on your breast cancer type. So there are two broad categories. There's breast conservation, which includes removing the tumor plus adding radiation. Now, in some very low-risk categories that have that well-behaved luminal A tumor, and women who are older, I think the recommendation is over 70 with a low-grade tumor, they can sometimes be considered for omission of radiation, so just surgery. But in general, people will either have the lumpectomy plus radiation or mastectomy, and the survival between the two is the same, meaning that bigger surgery doesn't mean improved survival. That being said, if the breast is left in place, you do have a higher risk for local recurrence, and that local recurrence could lead to a distant metastasis, which could affect your survival. The big thing to recognize in breast cancer is that a cancer in the breast does not affect your lifespan. Mm-hmm. You can remove the cancer in the breast. A cancer in the armpit doesn't affect survival. And so the survival for stages 1, 2, and 3 are all very high. Even for stage 3 disease, there's a 70 to 95% 5-year disease-free survival. That's stage 3. So it's not until the cancer gets out of the breast and the lymph nodes and spreads to the bone, liver, okay, lungs, brain, that it actually affects survival.
Okay. So that's what I was going to define with stage 4 is the metastasis.
Correct.
So,
and it sounds like screening and that, paying attention,
mm-hmm,
and being proactive and,
mm-hmm,
having good medical care,
mm-hmm,
that and understanding of the 3 different types, mm-hmm, and all of that.
Yes. And most of the big advances in breast cancer treatment over the last 20 years have been improvements in systemic therapy. And that's not for women who have metastatic disease, but it's preventing distant disease from growing. So say that there are a couple cells that have broken off the tumor in the breast and they're circulating in the blood, and one or two cells tries to set up shop in the bone. But if you get a good chemotherapy regimen, it kills that cell and it never has the opportunity to grow into an established metastasis.
I've also heard that some people have had hormone therapy first and then chemo, then the mastectomy. Is that very common, or?
That would be pretty uncommon to have the endocrine therapy before. The standard order is surgery, chemo if you need it, and not everybody does. That depends on the tumor type.
Mm-hmm.
Radiation, and not everybody needs radiation. That depends on if it's spread to the lymph, mm-hmm, nodes, mm-hmm, how big the tumor is, what surgery you picked. And then very last is endocrine or hormonal treatment for usually 5 to 10 years.
Okay. And that's the tamoxifen is the,
correct,
the estrogen blocker.
Yep, tamoxifen or anastrozole.
Okay. So can you share your treatment, Cynthia?
Oh, sure. So I did have a mastectomy, and I had, initially they said that is all you need. However, the one lump, because I had a high risk of recurrence, I ended up having chemo. And then I took the, what's called an aromatase inhibitor or the estrogen blocker for 5 years, although there are saying now 5 to 10 years, but I'm kind of holding at 5. But one reason I took that was because my oncologist explained to me that not only would it decrease the risk of recurrence, it would actually makes the bones more resistant to cancer, like Dr. Robbins was saying. And I thought, well, that was a reason for me. But it can be a difficult medicine to take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have an association with someone who actually then got a an elective oophorectomy because you got tired of taking the medicine or didn't like taking the medicines. You know, but anyway.
Yeah.
That's a pretty drastic, but again, that helped the side effects of, but then you have the side effects of not having your own personal estrogen, so.
People are very complex. I think that's what we need to remember is that women, people are complex, and every treatment regimen is so individualized, you cannot possibly kind of say, well, this is going to be the treatment plan. It has to be personalized for that woman and her care providers.
But I guess what I've been hearing from friends is that hormone therapy, some people are having it before surgery, which I thought was like totally, you know, different. And I'm not sure if that was an Ohio State study or what it was, because again, people share part of what they part of their history, but they don't always share everything.
Sometimes we'll put folks on the hormone therapy before surgery to see if we could shrink the tumor down. That rarely works. That works more commonly with chemotherapy. So if you have a woman with a large tumor who wants to save the breast, then we will often do what's called neoadjuvant chemotherapy, where we give chemotherapy up front. You can watch the tumor sometimes shrink away from that chemotherapy and end up with a smaller surgery because of the response to it. If the woman's not a candidate for chemo because of that gene assay that Cynthia was talking about, where they test the tumor and see, will this tumor even respond to chemotherapy? And sometimes the answer is no. Sometimes they'll try the hormone therapy in that same situation.
Has the chemotherapy gotten better tolerated? Or?
Well, I don't know about better tolerated, but it's more effective.
I will tell you, here's my experience, because, you know, you read stories about women who keep mountain climbing and running marathons, and they do this all while they're having chemo. And so, of course, when I could not get off the couch, I thought something was wrong with me. So I would really encourage women to not set themselves up for this big expectation and to just really take care of yourself, have people around you who can take care of you, and kind of have your little nest where you can go, and just knowing that there is an end to this.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That sounds really good. Here's a little anecdotal. My grandmother had breast cancer, and I think she died from it. My mother did not. She had breast cancer. But my mom always said, the good news is they're always finding out new things. You'll be okay. Mm-hmm. Just get your screening. Mm-hmm. And I love that advice, because that is true. What you're talking about, Dr. Robbins, is so, and Cynthia, so many new things are happening all the time, and right around the corner there's something new mm-hmm. that we don't know about yet. So, and Cynthia, your advice to women who might be going through stuff like this is take care of yourself, get a team of people behind you, and, you know that survival is on the high end.
When do you recommend reconstruction surgery? You know, and or, I mean, there's some women who just say, oh, I'll just get a prosthesis and I'm fine. I'd rather not have to deal with surgery. And other people definitely want reconstruction, and the whole story with the silicone implants and having mm-hmm. some people have, they were taken out and then starting over and various mm-hmm. methods.
So I tell anybody who wants one, and is a candidate for a reconstruction, that they should get one. There are some absolute contraindications. So for example, if you had a woman who was obese and a smoker and a diabetic, there's probably no plastic surgeon in the country who would do a reconstruction. But if they're a candidate for that, then I think that they should do it. I think it's very worthwhile. One thing that I employ a lot in my practice is something called oncoplastic breast surgery, where you worry about, or at least pay attention to, the cosmetic result of the surgery up front. So if a woman's getting a mastectomy, you think, well, can we do the mastectomy and preserve the nipples? Mm-hmm. And therefore, she'll have a more natural looking breast. And mm-hmm. sometimes you can, depending on the shape of the breast. If a woman's getting a lumpectomy, how can we do this lumpectomy so she doesn't have a huge divot mm-hmm, out of mm-hmm, her breast mm-hmm. that looks bad. And so the way that you do that is you rearrange the existing breast tissue, take some skin out. And so I tell patients it's like taking a piece out of a pumpkin pie and then pushing it back together and smoothing out the pumpkin so the breast is smaller, but it still looks like a normal breast. And then we can actually do a breast lift on the other side to kind of lift both nipples up, and then they look great.
So do you don't do that at the time?
I do that at the time
of the mastectomy.
At the time of a lumpectomy.
A lumpectomy.
So if I'm doing a lumpectomy that is be big enough to require some rearrangement, I'll rearrange the cancer breast, and then I'll lift the non-cancer breast in the same surgery.
Okay. Interesting.
Almost like artwork.
It's very much like artwork.
I woke up and went, wow.
Okay. So that's a big push in breast cancer right now, just because people are becoming more aware of, you know, women caring what their breasts look like options, in addition to caring about their cancer being treated. And that's okay.
So again, if you had a mastectomy, the reconstruction timing would be?
Oh, good question. When? So if you had a mastectomy, there are different options. So you can have an immediate implant-based reconstruction, which means you have your mastectomy by the general surgeon, so say by me, and then the plastic surgeon then comes into the operating room and can do the first stage of a reconstruction, which is a tissue expander. Some plastic surgeons don't like to do that as much because the complication rate is higher when you do them both in the same setting, but it's an acceptable risk, and a lot of people go that way. They then come back in about 2 months and exchange the tissue expander for an implant. So it's two surgeries minimum. The other option is, as opposed to an implant-based reconstruction, which is some form of plastic, it's either a plastic capsule with saline in it or silicone. The other option is a tissue-based reconstruction, which people have probably heard about, a tram flap or a deep flap, which is where tissue is taken from the abdomen, and then they swing it up on a vascular pedicle and make it into a breast. And so you get kind of a tummy tuck breast reconstruction in the same surgery. And so it works great. There are also complications that are associated with that. But, you know, I think for the right patient, it's a great option.
And then, of course, there are support groups around, and do you refer people automatically, or Cynthia, did you refer people to support groups?
Well, I have an affinity for the community cancer services since I was one of the people who helped get that started with Heather Gibson. And I think they're a great resource that we just have here in our local community, and they have, gosh, they have money for gas, and they have wigs, and they have prosthetics, and they have someone to talk to. So that's not just for breast cancer, it's for all cancers. But I will tell you, there are many through Kootenai Cancer Center, and certainly in Spokane, there are a lot of support groups.
Do you find people reluctant to identify themselves as support groups? I mean, some people want to just push it under the rug, and some people want every, you know, help, and are very, you know, much more active in pink ribbons, you know, raising money, doing something like Komen or some other fundraiser, and other people just kind of don't talk about it.
Sure. I mean, I have the women who have had breast cancer who stopped getting mammograms on the other breast, and that just drives me nuts. Mm-hmm. But so there's an entire continuum
the
here.
The denial.
Of your how much you want to participate in this diagnosis.
Wow. Well, ladies, that was really, really informative. Is there anything we've missed or that we want to add to this conversation?
I think the most important thing for women to recognize is that a diagnosis of breast cancer, while it's going to be a rough couple months, you're going to have surgery, maybe radiation, maybe chemo, there's a light on the other side, and there's such good treatment for this cancer that it's not a death sentence. You know, it's a hurdle to overcome, and you'll grow through the process.
We have talked about self-exams, so don't be too paranoid and do them on the same date but be familiar
with. Don't do them every day.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah, no.
Women do them every day. Like, no, too much.
We didn't talk about lymphedema, and I'm thinking about my mother-in-law, and just two interesting stories. One is she had her mastectomy. She was like 70, I'm trying to, 70 or closer to 80, no, 70 something. But anyway, she, 72. She had a mastectomy. She had chemo. She had radiation. She never lost her hair. We kept going, did you get the right dose? But, you know, basically, she never had any side effects. And but she did have terrible lymphedema in her arm. And there are physical therapists that focus on that. Do they have that resource here in Sandpoint?
Absolutely. Yes.
So.
Yes, we have some great physical therapists
here. Yeah,
very
good ones. Mm-hmm.
How common is that now?
Lymphedema with an axillary dissection, which means a surgery to take all the lymph nodes out of the armpit, which we don't do nearly as much as we used to, but it is necessary if you have gross disease, gross meaning big disease in the armpit. The risk for lymphedema is about 20%, which is pretty high. Okay. And if you get radiation afterwards, which most people do, it goes up even higher.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me to highlight October as Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I really appreciate your contributions. A few more dates for our listeners to remember. October 13th is Metastatic Breast Cancer Awareness Day. And October 17th to the 23rd is Men's Breast Cancer Awareness Week. And I read that 2,790 or almost 3,000 men will be diagnosed each year, which is, you know, totally amazing. Mm-hmm. I knew one man who had breast cancer. And about one in five will die of breast cancer. And thank you all for listening to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne. Please do remember, this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. Please tune in next month on November 4th when we'll be discussing National Adoption Awareness Month. This is 88.5 KRFY, community-supported radio for North Idaho.